Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Thomas Sugrue, author of a classic book of Detroit and the American Urban Crisis, on that city's long decline, culminating in its recent bankruptcy filing. And then we'll hear from the Dean of American Crime and Punishment Statistics, Alfred Bloomstein, on whether the long incarceration boom is coming to an end. First up, Thomas Sugrue. Sugrue is the David Boies Professor of History and Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. Sugrue's book, The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Postwar Detroit, published by Princeton University Press, is a classic of the field. Tom Sugrue. The Detroit bankruptcy, of course, has long roots, and a lot of people in the journalistic world are not big on long roots. So let's look back and try to figure out how Detroit got into this miserable pickle. Starting with what Detroit looked like at one point, you quote someone in your book as saying that the city was a total industrial landscape. What was Detroit like in its heyday?
Detroit was one of America's great boom towns. It was a place that expanded dramatically between the advent of the auto industry in the early 20th century and 1950. It was really, in some ways, the global center of industrial capitalism, or what came to be called Fordism, dominated by auto plants and then a ring of smaller suppliers and all the ancillary industries that kept the auto industry going. At its peak in 1950, the American auto industry directly or indirectly employed about one in every six Americans, and it was overwhelmingly concentrated in and around Detroit.
In the city limits proper, right? Not spreading beyond?
Well, it started to spread in the during the Second World War as the military-industrial complex came to the metro area and some of the new plants were built on the periphery, but it really started to decentralize in the late 1940s and especially in the 1950s as the auto industry, like lots of other big industries, went in search of cheap labor, low taxes, a so-called favorable business climate. And so what you see in that period is the steady hemorrhaging of manufacturing jobs from Detroit. Again, this is the 50s, not after international competition, and new plants popping up in small towns in Ohio and Indiana and later on in the South and the Sun Belt and, you know, by the 70s and 80s overseas, part of a long process of attempting to weaken the control of unions and to dodge environmental and labor regulations and taxes in states like Michigan.
And there's a tendency to think of the 50s and 60s as some sort of golden age, but it wasn't quite so golden as it might seem in retrospect.
Definitely not. I mean, Detroit lost 130,000 manufacturing jobs between 1947 and 1968. So we're talking about, you know, really big loss. And at the same time, you know, it began to lose population in 1950. It reached its peak at about 1.85 million and saw a steady decline thereafter, mostly because of the migration of whites away from the central city to the suburbs.
Yes, when we discuss Detroit, it's impossible to avoid getting into the matters of race. So Detroit was a major target of the black northward migration. Could you give us some sense of the timing and the scale of that?
Yeah, well, black migration began during World War I, and during the 1920s and 30s, Ford recruited fairly extensively among African Americans who came to the city to work in the auto industry. But it wasn't really until World War II that the auto industry opened up in a big way to African Americans, and that spurred a huge migration northward to the city. I mean, it was, you know, perceived by blacks as a land of opportunity, and for good reason. Unionized jobs, a UAW that was one of the more racially integrated institutions in the United States in the period, and what seemed to be jobs galore, and jobs that were way better than the agricultural and domestic work that had characterized life in the South.
And how did the employers deal with this growing black labor force, about hiring people, but also what kinds of jobs they were given?
Well, black workers usually ended up in what were called the meanest and dirtiest jobs, the bottom of the ladder jobs, working in the paint room, which was dangerous, or working on engines, or especially in Ford and other big plants, working in the foundry, which was where iron and coke and coal were, you know, put together to create steel. It was miserable, hot, dangerous, and unpleasant work. And by the 40s, foundries were, you know, 50% or more black in companies that had far fewer black workers in the workforce.
And this is a very conscious policy on the part of the employers.
Absolutely. You know, the thinking was basically that African Americans were best suited for the worst jobs, and given that there were still huge barriers to their employment all over the place, they would take the kinds of jobs that many whites would refuse or would be, you know, really quickly promoted out of.
And what was the reaction on the shop floor? How did white workers greet their new black colleagues?
Well, it depended a lot on what plant, what union, or what union local. During World War II and after the war, there were sporadic hate strikes, that is, white workers walking off the job when the first black worker was introduced. But the UAW cracked down on those pretty heavily and created a Fair Employment Practices Department in the mid-1940s that worked to deal with questions of discrimination in the workplace. And so the hate strikes waned away by the mid and late 40s in most plants. But still, black workers tended to be concentrated in certain places and pretty much frozen out of all the well-paying, skilled jobs that were, you know, the aristocracy of labor in the auto industry.
You mentioned something about the union, but how did they deal with race relations within the membership?
Well, the UAW very early on made a commitment to organize across racial barriers. You know, it was Detroit's version of the black and white unite and fight strategy. You know, the argument being that the union's interests were best served by not, you know, pitting workers against each other by race or ethnicity. You know, there were struggles for leadership in the UAW. Many black workers believed that they were underrepresented in union leadership and pushed for inclusion, especially in the late 50s and early 60s. And so by no means was this a nirvana. There were racial tensions, but overall the UAW was way more progressive on issues of race than many unions and indeed most of America was in the period from World War II on forward.
Where did that come from?
It came from the, you know, importance of left activists in the UAW who were long committed to bridging racial divisions and creating a kind of a common class consciousness in politics. It had to do with the fact that when the auto industry began opening its doors to African Americans, the firms did not want to see a repeat of the using black workers, minority workers as scabs and pitting worker against each other. So they had a, you know, strategic reasons for doing it as well. And that, you know, I think, you know, the combination of, you could say, ideology and interest made the UAW more open than many to interracial workplaces.
Now, I want to talk about housing in a moment, but other unions were not quite so welcoming. The building trades, living up to their notorious reputation, were much more discriminatory. Talk about that a bit and why.
Well, building trades were discriminatory because they relied heavily on personal networks, family relationships. And, you know, if you're a black living in Detroit or any city in the United States in that period, or even really up to the present day in many places, you're not going to the same schools, you're not worshiping in the same churches, you're not drinking at the same bars, you're not playing on the same sports teams, you're certainly not intermarrying. And so you're not part of the network of personal connections that the building trades and other unions often rely on to get jobs.
Okay, and then housing, of course, is an enormous flashpoint with the black migration into Detroit. Give us the history of what happened there.
Well, African Americans move north and face pretty intense hostility almost from the get-go as they begin to move into formerly white neighborhoods. In Detroit, between the mid-1940s and the mid-1960s, I found in my research more than 200 violent racial incidents, usually targeting the first or second black family to move into a formerly white neighborhood. But that wasn't the only story. This is also a story of business and of government. That is, the real estate industry had it in its code of ethics not to introduce so-called incompatible groups into neighborhoods, and so it was considered unethical to sell a house to a black person in a white neighborhood. And the federal government, which dramatically expanded home ownership through the Federal Housing Administration, the Veterans Administration during World War II, explicitly restricted its mortgage guarantees to racially homogeneous neighborhoods. So essentially, if you were attempting to buy in a mostly black neighborhood or even a neighborhood with a handful of blacks in them, if they weren't domestic servants, it was very difficult to get a federally backed loan or mortgage. And so the consequences were that these federal policies essentially created a system of residential apartheid that became very difficult to dismantle even after official discrimination was ended in the 1960s.
And the realtors did a part too, didn't they?
Absolutely. I mean, the real estate industry was, you know, played an absolutely central role in dividing the city by race. And that, you know, that didn't stop with the passage of open housing legislation in 1968. I mean, real estate brokers are, you know, there's still studies that show that they steer, that is, make assumptions about the preferences of white or black homeowners and direct them toward particular neighborhoods and away from others. And, you know, it's possible to do that, skirting the very edges of anti-housing discrimination law. It happened to me when I was buying my first house in Philadelphia, where the real estate broker said, do your neighborhood research, when I wanted to look at a house in a predominantly black neighborhood. She never said, you know, blacks live here, don't move here, or, you know, your property values are going to be negatively impacted. But, you know, she had this euphemism that was very, you know, clearly meant to direct me away from looking at that particular property.
I'm speaking with Tom Segrew, a historian of Detroit and professor at the University of Pennsylvania. So then what happened over the – what were the contours of the changing racial makeup of Detroit?
Well, Detroit goes from being you know, an overwhelmingly white city to, by the early 1970s, the largest majority African-American city in the United States. And, you know, it's surrounded by a ring, really until the early 2000s, a ring of nearly completely white suburbs, a handful of communities excepted. And so what you have, in other words, is a metropolis that's really polarized by where people live, but also as a consequence, polarized politically. I mean, there's the hostility between the suburbs in Detroit around racial issues especially can't be underestimated. Talk about post-racial America, you know, aside, this is a place that where the most commonplace explanation for Detroit's problems is black misrule.
And what was happening to auto jobs in the 70s?
Well, auto jobs had already been fleeing Detroit in pretty big numbers in the period beginning in the 1950s, and that intensified in the 1970s with the rise of international competition, you know, particularly Japan and Europe. And, of course, by the late 70s, you have the oil crisis, the huge recession. You've got the Reagan recession of the early 1980s, and the auto industry is struggling mightily during that period. I mean, that's when Chrysler goes through its bankruptcy and restructuring. And during this whole period, jobs are hemorrhaging away from Detroit. There's a little bit of a boomlet in the late 80s and early 1990s as the American auto industry, you know, picks up, starts constructing SUVs, embraces this so-called just-in-time strategy that they borrowed from Japan, which is having parts suppliers really close to plants so they can order small batches and custom, almost custom produce cars. But that doesn't really stop the flow, which continues all the way up to the present day. There's only one auto plant today fully within the boundaries of the city of Detroit. There's one that straddles Detroit and a suburb. And that's it, right? So the auto industry is now not Detroit's most important employer, despite the fact that we still associate the auto industry with Motor City.
But the headquarters are still, what, in the suburbs?
General Motors is headquartered in Detroit. Chrysler and Ford are headquartered in the suburbs.
And are they important employers, or they just employ some rather limited number of white-collar staff?
Well, in the metro, they're important because, you know, almost all of the white-collar engineering research, advertising, et cetera, is all still based in and around Detroit. But auto manufacturing in the metro area has really plummeted, and you know, today in Detroit, the most important employers are, like they are in almost every major metro, every major big city, so-called meds and eds, hospitals, higher education, and especially the public sector. Without those, essentially Detroit doesn't have much of an economy today.
Now, when did the sense of crisis start setting in? When did people start thinking of Detroit as a place in crisis?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I mean, by the 50s, there were already people worried that automation and the flight of capital was turning Detroit from the arsenal of democracy into the what somebody called a ghost arsenal. But that sense of crisis, you know, really took off in the 1960s, especially after the uprising, the riot in 1967, which, you know, many still see as Detroit's turning point. I think they exaggerate it, but symbolically, that was the moment when to many, Detroit seemed to be facing woes. And then, you know, if you ask a lot of folks, the story of Detroit is worsened in the 1970s by, you know, the rise of the city's first black mayor and his racially polarizing rhetoric. This was Coleman Young. And it's still commonplace, especially among white suburbanites and others, to say, you know, everything was great in Detroit until 1967 and Young, and then racial polarization set in and the place, you know, skidded downhill fast. I think that's, you know, based on what we've been talking about, I think that's a pretty bad reading of history, but it's still pretty commonplace.
And so all along, the tax base was eroding to support any level of public services.
Absolutely. I mean, Detroit relied on the property taxes paid by, you know, its big employers. It relied on, you know, the property taxes from its from residents in the city, and, you know, the place's hemorrhaging population losing jobs, and it's seeing its tax base dwindle. And it's a big city. It covers almost 140 square miles. You know, it's got a massive infrastructure to maintain and fewer and fewer resources to do it. For a time, Detroit relied, as many cities did, on outside support from Lansing, Michigan State Capitol, and from Washington, D.C. But monies from the state and the federal government really started to decline, especially in the 1980s when the Reagan administration and its successors, you know, pretty steadily cut urban expenditures and in ways that, you know, left Detroit having to fend for itself as its population and economic base continued to atrophy.
And of course, the state is rather hostile to Detroit now, isn't it? Reflecting a rather hostile attitude among the broad Michigan population.
Oh, definitely. I mean, Detroit is viewed, I mean, dare I say, like the great Satan by most of outstate Michigan. They see it as a sinkhole of corruption, and you know, again, the racial politics play out pretty intensely. Most of the black population in Michigan was in Detroit, and so it's been extremely difficult for Detroit to get support from the state legislature and from the governor. And, you know, we've had a mix of Democratic and Republican control. But, you know, recently the Republican-controlled legislature and governor have been particularly hostile toward the city.
And how does the current Detroit crisis differ from the New York City crisis of the 70s?
Biggest difference between Detroit and New York, the federal government bailed out New York, despite Ford's famous, you know, drop dead to New York City. They provided, you know, a really substantial loan to the city that allowed it to pull itself out in the late 1970s. Detroit isn't getting any support from the feds or from the state, and so essentially it's being left to try to get out of its $18 to $20 billion hole by itself, and that's a huge shift that cannot be underestimated.
But Detroit doesn't have the resources to get out of that hole, does it?
No, absolutely. The best that Detroit's going to get is giving its creditors a big haircut and whacking the pensions of city employees and probably selling off a lot of the city's assets. I mean, right now there's talk of selling off, you know, the $1 billion-plus collections of the Detroit Institute of Arts. There's been talk about selling off many of Detroit's city parks, all as ways of trying to bring in additional revenue to the city. But it's going to be an uphill battle. That's a lot of money, and it's not as if Detroit has the local tax base to be able to make a dent into the, you know, into its huge debt.
And are the bondholders going to get priority over the city workers and retirees?
Well, that's the really big question. Right now, there are calls for, you know, cutting pensions by half, by three quarters, and if that happens, it's going to be devastating to the 20,000 or so retired city workers who, whose pensions average $19,000. For police and fire, it's about $31,000, but they don't have Social Security to rely on. So we're not talking about a bunch of retirees who are sitting around, getting fat off of the resources of the public fisc. We're talking about, folks who are, living in barely modest comfort as a result of the small pensions that they have. But, cutting those by, even 20% is going to be devastating for the resources of those households. And this is going to be battled out in the courts over the next couple of years. And it's not clear how that's going to play out. The financial institutions that hold a lot of Detroit's debt have a lot more political clout, have big law firms who are going to represent them, and have friends in high places in the state and in the federal government. So I'm not sanguine about how this is going to play out.
And what are the possibilities of some sort of Richard's Florida style recovery with hipsters and creatives moving into very cheap housing?
Well, I mean, you can now pick up a house in Detroit for somewhere between $5,000 and $20,000. I mean, housing is really cheap, and Detroit's become a magnet for creative types. But we're talking about a few thousand people in a city of 700,000. Pinning the city's financial recovery and urban revitalization on a bunch of artists and hipsters and on some coffee houses and fun bars and restaurants, I think, is a pipe dream. I mean, Detroit's more interesting for people like me to spend time in. There are better places for me to go out and and have a beer and shoot some pool and listen to some music than there were 20 years ago. But there's a kind of a messianic zeal among these gentrifiers that somehow they're going to save the city, and I don't see it happening. It's really, in evaluating urban revitalization, we have to look at what's impacting the majority of the city's residents. And Detroit's almost 85% black population is not, by and large, benefiting from hipsters moving to the city's midtown neighborhood or artists taking over old factories and turning them into lofts. And there's an assumption, mostly unchallenged assumption, that somehow the benefits of this gentrification are going to trickle down to the surrounding neighborhoods. And I think that's really problematic.
So is there some strategy that could lead to some kind of revival over the longer term, or is it a pretty grim picture?
Well, I think it's a pretty grim picture, but, Detroit has lots of assets. It's got a huge amount of empty land now, which already some developers are salivating over. It's right along the international border with Canada, which means that it's got a locational advantage in terms of its economy and trade. This isn't a turnaround that's going to happen quickly, and it may not happen at all. Our crystal balls are pretty cloudy when it comes to predicting whether cities are going to go up or cities are going to go down. But right now, Detroit's got a really, really long way to go, despite its vitality, the real optimism of city residents, and and its little pockets of revitalization. I think it's got a very, very long way to go to be able to have an economic base that's going to make it possible for it to rebound quickly.
And for that kind of revival, it would need some support from Lansing and or Washington, which is not apparently forthcoming.
That's right. I mean, the idea that somehow, city residents can do it themselves and that, poor and working class folks can marshal their resources through small-scale projects and transform the economy of a city or a metropolis is romantic. It's appealing on a gut level, but they have the will but not the capacity to really deal with these macroeconomic changes and the political marginalization that has afflicted Detroit for a really long time and doesn't seem to be getting better.
That was Thomas Segrue, a professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. His classic 1996 book, The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Postwar Detroit, is published by Princeton University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web, kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Put on my pressure suit. Put on my pressure suit. Put on my pressure suit. and the son of Pressure Suit by Adult, one of the stars of the Detroit techno scene of the late 90s, early 2000s. I know that's not the first thing that most people think of when they think of Detroit music, but I'm terrified of the obvious. Next up is Alfred Bloomstein, a professor at Carnegie Mellon who's been studying crime and punishment for many decades. There are two news hooks for this story. One is a speech given on August 12th by Attorney General Eric Holder, which contained the line, "Too many Americans go to too many prisons for far too long and for no truly good law enforcement reason." Obvious to me and probably you, but something of a surprise to hear coming from someone in his position. The second hook was a federal court decision earlier this week declaring New York City's stop-and-frisk policies unconstitutional. Under those policies, cops stop and pat down hundreds of thousands of people a year, almost all of them black and brown young men, merely on the suspicion that they're about to commit a crime. It's a brutally intrusive and oppressive practice, and Mayor Michael Bloomberg wants to keep it going. These two things together, while unrelated, made me wonder if the intense policing and incarceration policies of the last couple of decades are coming to an end. So I thought a call to Bloomstein might be in order. I must say as a preface that overall he's way too measured for my taste and way, way too friendly to the NYPD's stop and frisk policies. Sometimes I like to let bourgeois experts speak so we can hear how they think, which is why I didn't get into a debate with him. But I'm going to have a more critical voice on next week to talk about stop and frisk. Alfred Bloomstein. We've seen a couple of events over the last week that have been taken as a harbinger of a rethink on our crime and punishment policies. Attorney General Holder's speech on excessive incarceration, and the federal court decision declaring New York City's stop-and-frisk policies unconstitutional. Is something going on here?
Both of those are quite different events.
Right, they're totally unconnected, of course, but is there some kind of broader change underway on crime and punishment?
I think it's been underway for a while. One of the few issues on which the left and right seem to agree is reduced prison populations for different reasons. One is, from the left, it's a sense of excessive punitiveness. From the right, it's a sense of, boy, is this using a lot of money inefficiently. But there seems to be agreement that for about 50 years until the early 70s, the U.S. had an incarceration rate of 110 per 100,000. And it was impressively flat over that period, fluctuating about 8%. But 110 or 0.11% of the U.S. population. We're now at 500 per 100,000 in U.S. prisons. And add another 250 in local jails, so we are the world's leader in incarceration. And I think there's a growing recognition of is that an effective way? And a major thrust of all of that reconsideration is what good are we doing with our very heavy punitiveness about drugs? And that was obviously the major thrust of the Attorney General's talk. I did an address in 1992, 21 years ago, just after the election of a new president, Bill Clinton. And the argument was, briefly and basically, when you lock up a rapist, you take his rapes off the street. When you lock up a drug seller, you recruit a replacement. As long as the market demand is out there, and arguing for much more thinking carefully about how can we be effective about drugs. And that was a time when we were suffering from some, I would say, mindless responses to what was widely seen as a drug problem in the country. And there's no question that it is a problem. But incarceration is not a terribly effective means for dealing with it. And what is widely seen as the failure of the drug war is recognition of the fact that it's not a terribly effective way to deal with a drug problem, which is fundamentally a public health problem.
We've seen a very dramatic decline in the crime rate over the last decade or two. What is the contribution of the incarceration boom in your estimation?
there were a couple of estimates of the effect of incarceration during the crime. The big crime drop was in the 90s. From about 93, when there was a peak, to 2000, there was a drop of about 45% in murder, in terms of crimes. That was an impressive drop. Much of that was attributable to the thinning out of the crack market, as young people saw what crack had done to parents, to siblings, to friends, and so the demand for crack went down. What created the rise from the mid-80s until 93 was very largely associated with crack, as young people were recruited into the market as replacements for the people who were stuffed into prisons. Drugs. Prisoners now account for about half of the federal prison population and about 20% of the state prison population. So that we've seen that impressive growth. Now, in terms of the impact of incarceration on the crime drop, first I ought to point out that between 85 and 93, when crimes were going up, incarceration was going up also. Incarceration was going up during the 90s until 2000, and during the period when crime was coming down. And there have been estimates that about 25% of the crime drop is attributable to the growth of incarceration during that period. Finding all the factors that contribute to the crime drop is an intriguing and complex task. Certainly an important part of it has been the growth of incarceration for about 25%. Another important part was the change in demand for crack, which reduced the crack markets, reduced the violence associated with the crack markets, and there was a robust economy that could absorb the young people who were no longer needed in those crack markets. It's also the case that during that time there was very aggressive action by police in getting guns out of the hands of people in a variety of ways, and thereby deterring the carrying of guns as well as removing the guns that were too often used as a "I'll get him before he gets me" encounter in the street. And there are undoubtedly other explanations. I've heard about the presence of lead as contributing. I haven't sorted that one out. There's no question that there was a growing sophistication by police in their management and operations, and that was going on during that period. So lots of things were happening, all of which contributed to this big drop until 2000. Starting in 2000, things were fairly flat from 2000 to 2008. And then there was another big drop in 2009 of about 8% in that 1 year. So we've seen incarceration contributing, but by no means was it the dominant factor.
New York has seen a continuing decline in the crime rate back to early 1960s levels, while Chicago hasn't. What's responsible for the contrasting fate of the two cities?
Certainly, New York has been a leader in, number one, police management. Number two, the stop and frisk has certainly been a factor contributing to it in New York. The problem with the stop and frisk works in two ways. One is incapacitation, in just as prison works in two ways, through deterrence and incapacitation. Incapacitation by detecting a gun and confiscating it, but more likely in deterring the carrying of guns. So Certainly that has been an important contributor to the impressive drops in New York City. But I think you've got to combine that with very sophisticated management, sophisticated response to events that are occurring, savvy response to hotspots. CompStat was a very important part of managing by making precinct commanders responsible for the crimes in their neighborhood and having them respond to a board that would make suggestions on how they could do a better job of controlling their crime. So New York City has been exemplary in a lot of ways, and obviously Stop and Frisk has its problems. And I suspect that one might argue that New York City carried it much further than it should have, which is what gave rise to the suit and the judge's ruling.
You argue that Stop and Frisk has been effective. Lots of people say it isn't. It's just harassment based on race and age and dress.
Well, it's awful tough to get a good measure of how effective it was as a deterrent to get people to carry it. It's clear that widespread stop and frisk is going to, number one, get lots of people who aren't carrying anything, but thereby send a message to them and their buddies that if they do carry, they might be in trouble. I think New York City undoubtedly went too far in doing it too broadly, not having sufficient provocation for the stop. And it's tough to sort out how much of it was an incapacitation effect, which was obviously reduced, and how much of it was a deterrent effect. And the deterrent effect is a consequence of the widespread searches without necessarily finding anything.
It also comes at a very high price in civil liberties terms with the racial profiling.
It certainly comes at a high price, and the racial profiling, it would be important to get a much better sense of the community in terms of the degree to which the community might feel that it has achieved safety, and the price of that safety may be the excess of the stopping and of the frisking. I'm not in New York. I haven't witnessed what goes on in New York, but it strikes me, number one, that they didn't have to have people empty their pockets. If they found a joint in the pocket, that isn't necessarily a desirable outcome of arresting the individual for that joint. There's a sensitivity that police could engage in about explaining why they're doing what they're doing. So I have no question that there was some deterrent effect. It's clear that there wasn't that much of an incapacitation effect, but I think it was excessively and done and without sufficient attention to the concerns in the community where the violence was going on, where they were doing the searches.
I'm speaking with Alfred Bloomstein, a professor at Carnegie Mellon. What about the idea of outfitting cops with video cameras on their uniforms, part of the court decision?
I think it would be very useful to, number one, give the police officer some feedback on the insensitivity he displays when he is insensitive, and provide an incentive to him that he's being watched in terms of what he's doing out there. So it seems to be reasonably sensible to be used by their commanders to get them to behave in a more sensitive and savvy way as they interact with the public, particularly the public that uh, they may be suspicious of carrying guns or part of the deterrent effect in the communities where the risks of violent crime are high.
Are there aspects of New York policing practice that other cities should think about importing?
One is developing some of the sensitivity that I suspect in their stop and frisk so that they are not blatantly discriminatory and hostile to the community that they're patrolling. I think it's got to be seen as a friendly gesture by the as friendly activity by the community as part of providing protection, not as a hassle, and also finding the hot spots where the violence is going on, where they providing some information, intelligence on who the gangs are that are involved in some of the violence, so that they can be much more savvy and intelligent in who they're stopping and who they're frisking. And if the purpose is guns rather than marijuana, that the intrusiveness of a frisk should not be seen as a broad search and a widespread search of just about everybody passing by. So a lot more opportunity for training, for sophistication, for management of a process that could be helpful in controlling crime where the rates are high.
With the 2 million people we have in prison, what would the effects going to be in the coming years of releasing them back into their communities and trying to live normal lives?
Well, this certainly represents an important problem, particularly in the context of a weakened economy with job opportunities very limited, so that it's important that we do things that start building the economy that will accommodate these folks. But also that there are roles for prisoners who have done wrong and have come back to the community and can be part of a program of training them to do what they've done in Chicago with some degree of effectiveness, of being not part of the police operation, but part of the dispute resolution operation in the community. Individuals who know the community, who are savvy, and can be hired for peacemaking functions in the community. The flip side of that, by the way, is also the issue of redemption, that there are far too many cases of individuals who did something stupid when they were young, got a criminal record, and that hangs over them even though they're 40, over 20 years later, when they still can't get a job. So you've got to find better policies for dealing with the issue of redemption of people who have turned their lives around or did something stupid that was not necessarily a part of their lives when they were young. That's the thing that lots of young people do. In fact, over 40 years ago, there was an interesting and important study that estimated the probability that a male would get arrested sometime in his life. The estimate then was 50%. I was involved in that effort. And I was sure that a decimal point has been slipped. I thought it would be 5%, but indeed the estimate was right. This was by Ron Christensen, and that was before we started doing all the arresting we do now for drugs and for domestic violence and lots of things that we arrest for that we didn't arrest then. And this was 50%. Than for non-traffic offense, so that And DUI, which is a major issue now, which was hardly an issue then. So we're certainly overusing the criminal justice system without adequate appreciation of the saliency of an encounter with the criminal justice system.
Finally, the incarceration rate peaked a couple of years ago and has been drifting lower since. Do you see that decline accelerating?
The national rate has been flat in the states and rising in the federal system. Now, the federal system is about 10% or so of the state system, but the federal system has been rising and is slowing down in its rise. The states have been impressively flat for since 2000. Dropped a little bit last year, but the states have not come down dramatically, and if we're going to get back to somewhere like that 110 per 100,000 that I mentioned, which is the same range that the other industrialized countries we identify with are in, dropping from 500 to 110, or the states are now at 450, that they're going to have to do a lot more than they're doing now. They've got to do a lot of rethinking about the drug issue. They've got to do a lot of rethinking about the major increases we did in the length of time served. Much more thinking about alternatives to incarceration, much more in the way of community service, community control, community sanctions, so that it really has to be a major rethinking, and rethinking all of the mandatory minimum laws that were imposed during the mostly the 80s and 90s, while people were concerned about the growing crime at the time, and they were kind of mindless. They'd start with a two-year mandatory minimum. That didn't do much good. They'd up it to a five-year mandatory minimum. That didn't do much good. Then they went to a 10-year mandatory minimum, and that didn't do a lot of good because these were targeted very heavily at drug offenses, and the people out in the street doing drug marketing had far more risk from their competitors than they did from the criminal justice system in any event. So that doing a lot of and if they don't have the political courage to repeal those laws, then it would be the least they could do is sunset them and pass a law that says that they expire in 3 years if they're not shown to be effective, and do an analysis over the 3 years to see what effect they have had to restore more sanity to the punishment process.
That was Alfred Bloomstein, a professor at Carnegie Mellon. A clarification first. His description of the NYPD's approach as lacking sensitivity is a vast understatement. Their stops and frisks are massive and indiscriminate, and I'm skeptical that the higher-ups are all that interested in assuring sensitive treatment of populations that are suspect merely because of their age, dress, and color. And second, a fact check. Politics of stop and frisk aside, I didn't have the nerve to challenge Bloomstein on the decline in the incarceration rate because of his stature in the field, but it turns out I was right and he was wrong. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the incarceration rate for both state and federal prisons peaked in 2008 and is down just over 5% since. It's still way too high, but these are the first declines in the incarceration rate since 1972. That decline has taken us back to 2002 levels, but it's still over five times that 1972 rate, which was itself the lowest rate since 1927. If we could get back to that 1972 rate, there would be about 1.3 million fewer people in prisons, which would be a very good thing. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the liberation from prison scene of Beethoven's Fidelio, performed by the Bavarian State Orchestra and Chorus under Colin Davis. Till next week, bye.